before, well, you know, they stomp out, right? Like
yep.
a tantrum.
Yep.
They come back. They get exhausted. They tire out. It's the same. Exactly the same process. I mean,
I think it's an interesting analogy.
Just, you know, and they talk about it, disciplining children and things like that, just tireless but optimistic and to keep going in the face of huge, you know, don't lose your cool because that only, and it also is, I think, a point where you can have these breakthroughs for yourself, your children, you know, so I guess,
well, I think again the analogy is well taken. It's not, as most analogies, it's not perfect, but it is illuminating. It's illuminating. Yes, Katrina.
Well, I was just wondering, when he got to the 1 million and he nailed it down right away, he just said, okay, we've got an agreement. How do you know that you've come, is there a way to feel out that you've come to a solid agreement without a relapse? That the parties may not, they may come to the decision, you nail it down, you sign the agreement, and then somebody decides, wait a minute.
No, that's too late. Now, let me speak about that. That's very important. The reason that he, in the context of this video, although it seems silly the way he transitioned on the screen, but basically he wanted to show you that closure and getting at least the bullet points of an agreement down on paper and initialed or signed by the parties is absolutely critical because, and by the way, this will not be true in clinical mediation. Not be true. But in a legal context, if he had not done that, it is very conceivable that the parties may have second thoughts, come back and said, no, I don't agree. The other side would say, oh yes, but you did agree, but there's no document to evidence the agreement. Therefore, they can say, well, we never did X, or no, I didn't agree with that point, because they never committed themselves. And so he gave you not only bullet points in the agreement, but enough material that if push came to shove, you would have an enforceable contract. And ultimately, in almost any jurisdiction where there is a mediation, that mediation agreement can ultimately be converted into the equivalent of a judgment. Or, depending upon the judge and depending upon the jurisdiction, it might be appended to a stipulation of the dismissal of the case by the attorneys, or it might just be cross-referenced in that stipulation of dismissal. But once that document is signed, and personally, he didn't ask, but I would have asked, and I would have put down on that paper, do you agree that this bullet point document constitutes an enforceable settlement? And had them sign on to that as well. Because you see, the court, even if there's a missing piece, as it turns out later, if the parties agree that it's an enforceable settlement and the elements of an agreement are in place, then the court can either send the matter back to mediation to fill in what is a purported gap, or the court can itself make an interpretation of what the parties meant in that signed agreement. Although that is relatively rare. But if you have, I don't want to spend too much time on details, but at the end of the day, in legal cases, just as frequently, if not more frequently than what we saw here, the bullet point agreement then gets handed to one or both of the attorneys to draft a formal agreement, which the parties subsequently sign. And the attorneys can still argue about the phrasing and the language in the agreement. Again, my practice would be to say that if the parties intend to craft a formal agreement, that in the event that they run into a dispute about the language in the formal agreement, they come back to me, the mediator, and there's another example where 9 out of 10 times, in my personal experience, if you can't agree, do you want me to make the call? Absolutely. You make the call. Right? In other words, the call is consistent with all of the bullet points of the signed or initialed agreement, but if they're debating about, you know, whether they should say why or wherefore, they're not going to have the settlement fall apart. We're just going to fix it either by mediating it or ultimately arbitrating the issue of what the parties meant. Okay? Actually, if you would put on, Katrina, the next slide, I think these will also help us kind of go back and clarify some of the stuff that you guys have raised. So I made up some slides that I, as you can see, describe as the mediator's role in managing the process. And we've talked about pretty much all of the things that this mediator was trying to implement to one or another degree. So what does a mediator do? They educate the parties about the process. Remember, he started with an opening statement in which he described what he was not going to do. He's not going to make judgments, that he was, in effect, going to help them come to their own resolution. Amy.
I was a little surprised how in his opening statement he said that we're going to talk together and then I'm going to caucus with each of the parties and then we'll come back together. At least in the mediation intensive, you really only caucus when you feel the need to.
He said that he was going to caucus with the parties at the outset.
Yeah, I think he said
we'll talk together and then we'll caucus and then come back.
Right.
You probably wouldn't say that in the clinic.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that when we're talking about healthcare mediation. But one of the reasons that you would not be likely to give the kind of opening statement in the clinic that you would in a legal case is for an incredibly weird reason. In the clinic, the parties will frequently not know they're in a dispute. And so they'll be shocked. If you were to give them the kind of description of what you're about to do, it's almost as though they're going to be scratching their heads and say, I didn't even know I was in a dispute. You know, they don't really quite, they haven't usually processed. Sometimes, of course, there's a breach that's evident and nobody can deny. But a lot of times, they're just seeing it as a kind of a point of confusion, all right? But in terms of him saying that, the only thing that I would beg to differ on is that myself, I use caucuses not as something that has to be programmed into the format, but rather on an as-needed basis. And the longer the number of years that goes on that I function as a mediator, the more I invest in what can be done in global session before breaking into the caucus. So I myself wouldn't say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. What I would say is that you may find that at various points we may elect to conduct a caucus and explain to them why we can do that here and why I don't have the same problem that the judge does playing that role. Okay, which is part of educating the parties about the process. Okay, so we do try, to the extent that it's appropriate in the given context, to help to educate them about what this process can do for them, and to make them fully aware of the fact that this is their process, it's not mine. And in a legal case, it's not the courts, and it isn't even the attorneys, it's really for them. And I invite them, even when they are represented by counsel, subject to the advice of counsel, to participate actively in the process. They facilitate communication between the parties by projecting impartiality, probing, as we said, and asking both open-ended and pointed questions, And then something that I didn't get to yet, which is extremely important, and which inexperienced mediators rarely are naturally inclined to do. Your job, in part, as a manager of the process, is not only to make sure that when party A says X, it's heard as X, meaning you know that it was stated clearly enough that in fact probably party B understands X, but even if it was, did party B in fact understand it as X? So you're a translator and clarifier, which is separate and distinct from yet another important communicator role, which is your responsibility for summarizing at every stage where the parties are at. If you don't do that, you will probably be surprised to see that the, I'll call it, the institutional memory of the mediation on the part of the disputants can be very poor. And so it's your job to make sure that we are constantly aware of what has been agreed upon and what is still in dispute, and doing that regularly so you never allow it to get to a point where if there's been a misunderstanding, that the whole thing unravels because it's been built on sand. And you've got to do that, and that's not something that people do in the normal course of conversation, that you have to learn to do almost as an automatic response to what's being said by the parties to the mediation. You get to conduct, as we see, global and individual sessions to optimize the process. Katrina, next slide, if you would. Can't emphasize enough the importance of the next piece. Acknowledging the parties. Acknowledging the parties is a big word. It means not that just that you're acknowledging their presence and their role in the dispute, but it means that you are making them aware of the fact that you hear them. You understand the importance of this dispute to them. You value their contributions to the process. So that, for example, when they make a suggestion, or when they make a recitation of facts, there are ways to thank them for contributing that to the process. And so instead of just letting them speak, stopping, turning to the other person, you might be inclined to say, thank you very much for that statement, Mr. Jones. That's very helpful. And then turn your attention. Clearly, eye contact is important. What was referred to as a possible shortcoming of Eric's mediation in looking frustrated or upset or disappointed with the fact they weren't behaving as he might have liked them to behave, it would be nice to eliminate those kinds of affect from your responses. And referring to their competencies, which certainly Eric did quite well, and which as healthcare mediators is at the crux is of what you do. Because in a situation where you have a doctor and a patient, or a doctor and a family member, in which the power imbalances are so great, and they can be great in non-clinical mediations as well, but in clinical mediations, they're inevitably great. And what you can do in order to at least mitigate that power imbalance is to praise them for what they do bring to the table, which is not unrelated to the answer to tell me about mama. Because the physician, in order to diagnose and treat this person, needs that information. The physician is contributing professional expertise, scientific understanding,
and clinical experience, but needs the information as to who is this patient, what does she need, what kind of symptoms does she have, who is it that witnessed those symptoms, is their witnessing of the symptoms different than the patient's perception of the symptoms, and so forth. So we're dealing with all of that as a reference to and an acknowledgement of their special competencies that makes their presence at the table invaluable. We want to, yes, Richard.
One thing that the psychologists do, and I wonder if it's useful here, is very commonly when psychologists are doing family therapy, they'll use a reflexive statement. So that they'll listen to somebody go on, and they maybe get emotional, but as soon as they're done, they simply say, thank you. Now, as I understand it, you say you feel this way because, and that way, but in a less inflammatory way, make it clear to everybody that this is essentially what they're saying.
Absolutely.
Is that reasonable here?
Absolutely reasonable here. In fact, we might insert that as a third communication category, meaning repeat or reiterate, clarify, and then summarize. All three are very pertinent, particularly in the clinical setting. We, as you can see, all of these at some level promote mutual respect, as does eschewing judgmental behavior either on your part or on the part of others. So if somebody is, and this goes to Richard's comment as well, let's suppose that party A makes a statement that is acerbic in nature towards party B, but you can reframe the statement minus the acerbic component. You are helping in that situation to reduce the level of judgmental behavior, even though the party himself might not be capable of doing that. Encourage the parties to express feelings within the limits of civility and so on. We already discussed that as a component of optimizing the cathartic value of the experience. And Katrina, next slide. Back again to our integrative negotiation model. Help the parties identify their underlying interests and to recognize common or compatible interests. Help the parties move from competing to collaborating and acting as joint problem solvers. Help them to define the problem domain, as it's called. What are we doing here? What is the problem that needs to be solved? If you can identify the problem that needs to be solved, you can very frequently convert the disputants into contributors to the problem-solving process and get them to collaborate and make the problem the enemy instead of one another. Okay? And elicit and propose substantive and process options. Here, again, I'm referring not to what Eric did in becoming the arbitrator of the open issue, but there's nothing wrong when you have parties who are having trouble communicating and or finding options for a consensual resolution, for you to put options on the table, but not advocate for any one of them. You're merely giving them food for thought because you're implementing your role as a catalyst in their problem-solving behavior. And if they're stuck and they don't have ideas, you shouldn't feel constrained about contributing those ideas, but you are not lobbying for which one or ones they're going to choose. Now, Katrina, can I have the next slide? Here is something that we've been touching on throughout this conversation. And I just thought you'd get a kick out of seeing what your prior classmates have identified as the attributes that an effective mediator should possess. And I have this and one more slide. So why don't we look at both
both slides, and then we can see if there have been attributes that are not present on these lists that you would like to contribute as positive mediator attributes. Katrina, can we have the second page as well? So you see that there are quite a few, and in most cases, once you see the quality, I think it's not very surprising that these are, in fact, core qualities that you would want to have in a mediator. And many of them, let me just get this. You'll notice that trustworthiness is something that is not only essential for a mediator, but that many of these other positive mediator attributes will also contribute to the extent that the mediator is deemed trustworthy. In other words, these things, these elements don't stand on their own in a box. They're interactive, right? So, for example, somebody who is fair is more likely to be trusted than somebody who's not fair or not objective. Somebody who is respectful to others is more likely to be perceived as trustworthy than somebody who is brusque, inattentive, and rude, and so forth. And many of these things interact with one another as positive mediator attributes. Does anybody have anything they want to say about mediator attributes? Chelsea, did you? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Catherine?
It's Cassie, by the way.
Kathy.
Yeah, Cassie.
Yeah. Oh, Cassie.
Yeah. something I was thinking about was how it's so necessary for a mediator to be perceptive in the sense that they're able to gauge the energy of the two parties. I think important points in the negotiation that took place on the film was were kind of when there were breaks taken. And I don't know if that's always an option, whether there's time in situations in like clinical settings to really take a break and have people collect their thoughts. And it kind of just like worked into the day when it was the end of the day and they were able to consult with separate parties, with their companies. But I think that's, to me, is such an important attribute, is to be able to read people.
That's a good one. I would agree. Chelsea, did you have something as well?
I had another one, like persistence, which I think the word persistence kind of gets a negative rap sometimes.
Okay.
Is that on there? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's on the second page.
Was that on the second?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think that is on there.
Perseverance
is on there, yeah. For sure. And I think you can see how something like a sense of humor may not seem obvious, but in fact, where you're dealing with certain types of personalities, a sense of humor is often a requirement of being able to help the parties relax and to not take themselves as seriously as they might otherwise if you can bring some appropriate levity to the proceedings. You know, stature, let me be clear and also candid. Some of these attributes are not simply things that can be acquired as a result of your being desirous of having them. For example, stature. I think I actually, did I say that to you in joking?
I look young.
Yeah. Your youth. It's a lot easier for an old guy like me to be taken seriously by a bunch of cranky people around the table than somebody with the beatific face of Amy. And she's going to have a hard time overcoming that, but she will as she grows older and as her resume lengthens. So we aspire to wanting to be seen as somebody with stature, but as a practical matter, if you're a certain age and you haven't been around the block more than a certain number of times, you're sort of running uphill on that one. But we do aspire, nonetheless, to all of these things. And I think it's very important to keep them in mind. And, you know, I think I've said from the start that the issue here is never memorizing a list or saying, yeah, I agree with that. It's always about, can you dig into these ideas enough that it becomes internalized by you what these positive attributes are and how you want to see yourself in that role and what you would take pride in being able to implement as a mediator. So, you know, again, it's not, they're just words. They're only words. But what I want you to do is read these words in a way that makes them pertain to you in a meaningful way that you can absorb as part of your notion of what the identity of a mediator is. Okay? Yes, Andam.
I mean, it seems like the rules are arbitrary. I mean, it seems like the attributes are arbitrary. That's what I meant. There's really no there's no clear cut way, just like you said, you know, for a mediator. It's not defined in stone. It depends on who you're working with. It depends on the particular case at hand. You just have to use your discretion.
I am so glad that you said that, because that's right. I mean, there's a tendency as you go through the various topics that are relevant to learning about mediation to misunderstand, as Andam is indicating, that what we're talking about is black letter rules, that if you master them, you're going to be able to do this just fine. And say, oh, well, I know that, so I did that. Great, no problem. The fundamental fact is that the reason that this is as hard a job as it is there isn't a set of rules that you can check off and go by and say, I did X, therefore I will be effective. Every case is different, every party is different, all the issues are different, and the mediator must make comparatively instantaneous judgments that they're not always going to make correctly, but they're going to be making, having instilled in them this sort of body of experience and commitment to the nature of the issues that they learn about as being important for all mediators to engage. But you're not going to learn if A occurs, you must do X, or if B occurs, you must do Y. Because the variables are so infinite, and context is everything, everything. And it drives your handling of the process, but remember also the infinite nature of it is compounded by the fact that you are who you are. You're not me, I'm not you. The best mediator that Elizabeth can be is not the same as the best mediator that Ed Bergman can be, and vice versa. And we can be equally effective, but we're going to be very different in style and approach, and we're going to have to be aware of who we are and what we do well and what is less easy for us to master. And one finds ways of emphasizing the strengths and minimizing the weaknesses, as we do in almost any area that involves our persona. And nothing could be more dependent on your persona than this particular role that you guys have evinced an interest in playing. Katrina?
I was just wondering what kind of, where in the mediation is there room for the mediator to have each party reflect the other person's point of view, like actually state it, so that there's more empathy on either side? Is there?
Sure. I think Katrina is talking about role reversal and the fact that mediators will sometimes use different techniques like role reversal to help the parties be able to put themselves in the other party's shoes. And role reversal is one of those techniques, and it does work. I think you have to be careful not to make it stilted and foamy. I mean, it has to feel right, and it has to feel sort of endemic to the proceedings. And if you end up basically seeming like a drama teacher in making the parties go through those hoops, it's not going to play well. But taken in the right context, at the right moment, with the right people, it can be very, very powerful. Because essentially what you're asking them to do is tell you what they would feel or think if the circumstances were reversed. And they may end up making the arguments that they would make were they in the position that the other party was in. It is an effective technique, but as with all mediation techniques, handle with care. Yes, Richard?
One thing that's not on the list, and I think this distinguishes from the legal proceeding, is interest. And I think that when in legal proceedings, it seems the emphasis is more on the form and the facts rather than on, but I think that at least when I've been involved in mediation, it's been along the lines of, by appearing interested, I noticed the mediator really got rich, obtained commitments from both people, from both parties to the dispute.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think that speaks to another related issue, which is many times when people are in a dispute, they need more than anything else somebody to hear them, to listen to them, to acknowledge what it is that they're experiencing and feeling. Sometimes having that forum is as important, if not more important, than the formalities of the process or even the outcome. Because there are times, they're relatively rare, but they definitely happen, where having expressed what it is that has driven them to this point, the importance of the underlying substantive issue absolutely disappears. They don't even care anymore.
But also, I've noticed that in general, at least in the clinic ones I've been pulled into, it occurs after the female fan encounter. And the emotions are running fairly high, and the media that comes in says, this is an important question, we need to hear about it. By communicating that level of interest rather than dealing with it, you're just saying we're going to sit here till we get a resolution, or not showing real interest in the problem or the parties, seems to make a big difference as far as obtaining the level of commitment they're obtaining from the parties.
Now, I think that's well stated. There is also, you should know, there is a school of mediation that refers to itself as transformative. And the underlying premise that they work on is that the role of the process and of the mediator is to essentially reorient the parties' relationships towards one another, emphasizing at bottom the sort of commonality of the human experience and the extent to which each of us should be able to, if not agree with, but be able to comprehend, understand, and respect how and why the other person is who they are and is reacting the way they do. Now, oddly enough, although that seems pretty highfalutin and pretty new agey to me, and I was never really a big supporter, I got trained by those people because, incredibly, that is the school that the United States Post Office adopts as their training for mediation in their mediation program, which is called Redress. And it's sort of hard to believe that they are training mediators to do that, who are then going to be dispatched to various post office locations on 24/7 in order to deal with disputes between post office employees and their peers and or supervisors. It seems kind of odd, and yet they've been able to sustain this for quite a few years. I quit after I did the third one, but so it's not my thing, but you should know that there is that kind of school, and that, you know, they really do look at it as less a matter of the issues that are being placed on the table than as literally an attempt to reorient the parties' understanding of their respective roles. And I think when it's done with a great deal of experience and talent, it can be effective, but in my view, it would be a tremendous overstatement to believe that in commercial cases in particular, that that could be without the benefit of other kinds of mediation approaches be particularly effective. I think there are situations where it does work, even in bitter legal disputes that have the kinds of issues that are in this case, but that's the minority, in my view, not the majority of cases. Did somebody else have their hand up? I'm sorry, I want to make sure. Yeah, Bridge.
When you went through this list, to me, it kind of felt like a pretty tall order.
It is a tall order.
And that it's, most people don't have all of these things. Or it takes a long time to kind of build all that up.
It does.
Like, as you said, trust for truthfulness. You know, we have these one-off encounters with folks, especially in the clinical setting, like they don't really know you from a cake of soap.
Yeah.
How they know to trust you, you know what I mean? And also us as beginning mediators, how do we, it's almost like, how do we gain that experience needed to look legitimate, even if we're young?
Look, we're all human beings, and we all, look, the very fact that you're sitting here in this classroom, and you're one of this self-selected universe of people who cares enough to be engaged in this, means almost by definition that even if you don't in fact possess to the extent that you'd like to each and every one of these characteristics, you know what they signify, and you probably value them at some level. So the question here isn't, I think, a personality transplant. It's more a self-examination and sort of being able to say, well wait a minute, what aspect of my persona do I have to access in order to make sure that I do bring what I know is my creativity, my potential creativity, to the table? In other words, you have creativity. The question is, how do you unearth it, and how do you remember to bring it to bear in a given situation? So I wouldn't even put these things up here other than for you to be able to look at them and say, gee, I would have never thought of that myself.
Right.
If we were starting with a blank blackboard,
right?
And everybody was giving their names, I, Bridget, would not have said creativity. So I think what you want to do is look at this list and say, hey, you know what? I have creativity. It never occurred to me that that aspect of me would be a tremendous strength in my ability to carry this role forward. It's that kind of thing. Going once, going twice, and I will let you go until next week.